Now in session, and the case on our calendar today is the case of Hyatt Musay versus the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And as you know, appellant will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the department will likewise have 15 minutes. So let's get started. Mr. Mertz, can you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Greg Mertz with the Lathrop GPM Law Firm, representing the relator, Hyatt Musay.
All right, go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. Congress passed the CARES Act with overwhelming bipartisan support in order to provide $2 trillion in economic assistance that was designed to at least meet some of the financial harm resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic. As a result of the pandemic, millions of Americans have been out of work, and specifically to address that unemployment crisis, the CARES Act includes a temporary federal unemployment compensation program referred to as pandemic unemployment assistance, PUA, and that program is intended to assist people who are out of work because of the pandemic, but are not eligible for regular unemployment compensation under state law. Now, high school students make up a significant number of those millions that are now employed. They make up a significant number of amount of the workforce. Requirement to receive PUA and turn that into a basis for disqualifying high school students from receiving benefits under the program. Dean's position is directly contrary to the plain language of the statute that created the PUA program. The issue of whether Minnesota high school students are eligible for PUA is really a simple exercise in statutory interpretation and logic. First, the statute says that any covered individual is entitled to a maximum of 39 weeks of PUA benefits. Second, the statute says that in order to be a covered individual, you have to do two things. First of all, you have to be ineligible for regular unemployment compensation. And second, you have to self-certify that you are able and available to work, but you're unemployed because of one or more of the statutory specified COVID-related reasons. There's no dispute in this case that the relator is a high school student and is therefore ineligible for regular unemployment compensation. There's also
could I have you address though? I understand that you're referring to the actual statute, but if I look at the United States Department of Labor issued guidance, and they indicated in that guidance, and this was issued after the CARES Act, that the terms and conditions of the state law of the applicable state for an individual which apply to claims for and payment of regular compensation apply to the payment of PUA to individuals, and that any claims for PUA include but are not limited to disqualification, including disqualifying income provisions. And the argument, I'm sure, as you're well aware, of the respondent, is that this is what they were following, is these guidelines that were set out shortly after the adoption of the CARES Act. How do you respond to that?
Sure. So when the statute talks about the state law disqualifications applying, you still have to think about what does it mean to apply those disqualifications. What we believe, and we think that the statutory language provides and is also supported by the guidance is that the way it applies is that you use state law to determine whether a person is either eligible or ineligible for state law unemployment benefits. And so one of the things, and if you look at the actually the very next couple of paragraphs in that same guideline, what DOL is talking about is this is a federal program. It's funded by federal money. And what the state can't do is shift people who would otherwise be eligible for state benefits onto the federal side of the equation. If someone is eligible for state benefits, then it's the state's obligation to pay those benefits. But if you're in a position like my client and you're not eligible for those benefits, then that becomes a federal obligation under the PUA. So if you think of the covered individual's definition as creating a couple of sets of boxes, the first box is eligible for state benefits, ineligible for state benefits. You have to fit in one of those two boxes. That's the way the statute is drafted. And if you're not in box one, the people that are eligible for state benefits, you are necessarily in box two. And that's a question of state law. The state law applies to tell you which of those two boxes do you fall in. And is this a state expense or is this a federal expense? And as I've said, if you're in the position of my client, this is a federal expense because the state has disavowed any obligation to pay unemployment compensation to high school students.
So can I ask a quick question here? Setting aside the pandemic unemployment assistance program for a moment, your client would not be qualified for benefits just under the disaster unemployment assistance. Is that right?
That is correct as well. And that is because the disaster unemployment benefits has a specific regulation that relates to the eligibility of students. But here, and this was discussed in the party's briefing, what the DOL has said is that disqualification under DUA doesn't mean the person's not eligible under PUA. And really it's the PUA standard that has to take precedence in determining whether someone is eligible. So as I've said, the covered individual definition really creates a couple of sets of boxes. We've got the first two boxes, the eligible for state benefit, box one, ineligible for state benefits, box two. And it doesn't matter why you're not in box one. If you're not in box one, you're in box two. And then box two is further divided between people who are able to work but are unemployed because of COVID-19 and people for whom that's not the case. And if you're in the first of those two boxes, then that is the person that meets the definition of covered individual. The statutory language reflects Congress's intent to create a broad safety net. As the Department of Labor guidance makes clear, this is a benefit of last resort. And again, that gets back to the idea that if this person is eligible under state law, then they're entitled to that benefit. If not, they're entitled to this benefit of last resort. And so the coverage of federal law begins where state law ends. And so there are no gaps and there's no overlap. But what DEED has done here is to create a brand new box that's not found in the statute. It creates a box and then it puts into that box high school students. And there's no basis in the statute for doing that. And really it is not supported by law. So now DEED would acknowledge, I think, and obviously they'll be speaking for themselves here just a few minutes, but DEED would, I believe, acknowledge that if the definition of covered individual that is set out in the statute is broad enough to include high school students, then that's the end of the question. And we know that because there's a hierarchy of authorities that both parties rely on. And if the question is answered by the statutory language itself, then you don't need to look any further. Now, what DEED has argued is that the definition of covered individual is silent with respect to high school students because it doesn't use the words high school students. It doesn't specify high school students. And that's like saying that a city ordinance that says all dogs must be on a leash is silent with respect to whether it applies to white dogs. When the legislature uses a broad category, it doesn't have to specify all the constituents of that broad category. It's not the role of this court to narrow that category with language that the legislature did not use.
Now, if I could interrupt one more minute, the department included an addendum with their contract with the federal government. And so how does your argument fit into the contractual obligations between the state? Because that, I mean, it seems like a contract's a contract and they got to follow the contract.
They do, but you have to interpret the contract to be consistent with the statute that the contract is intended to advance. I mean, the only reason this contract exists is because there is this PUA program. And so it can't be the case that there's anything in the contract that could be read to overcome or trump anything in the statute. And so the court's focus really needs to be on what the statute provides.
And that applies to the UIPLs that those, I mean, is there a conflict between the contract and the interpretation letters?
I'm not aware of any conflict, and certainly Deed hasn't said that they're somehow bound by their contract to do something different than what either the statute or the guidance, the UPOL, IUPLs would provide. And so they're not making that argument. I'm not aware of any such conflict. And in fact, we believe that the statutory language and the UPO are both very are consistent with one another for the reasons that I've already described. The UPO explains how is it exactly that state law applies. Well, it applies to tell us who is eligible and who's not eligible for state benefits, therefore to determine who goes into box number two for PUA purposes. Because
may I ask, and maybe what you just said relates to this, and this is a question I was looking at page 42 of the respondent's brief, where they talk about, Deed talks about there being a legal distinction between individuals who are not eligible due to reasons that prevent them from establishing an account and those who are ineligible due to application of state law disqualification or ineligibility provisions. Talk about how that might not be an apparent distinction, et cetera. And then at the end says, if all individuals who are ineligible for regular unemployment benefits were eligible for PUA benefits, if they met the CARES Act criteria, USDOL's directions to apply state law disqualification provisions would be meaningless. I wonder if what you just said is the response to that argument, but I wanted to get a response to that argument.
Yeah, I think at least that's the first part of the response is when the guidance talks about how to apply state law, that's what it means, is you got to figure out who's eligible for state benefits in order to determine who's eligible for state benefits.
Council, when you turn away even slightly, we lose the audio, just FYI. So those directions, as you look at them, are more for purposes of just protecting sort of the federal FISC, that's what the disqualification is about. It's not to make sure that you're not paying for people who are disqualified under state law entirely.
Yeah, and it's for that purpose. And I think that if you look, they reference a specific paragraph A in paragraph 7A in the guidance. But if you look further at paragraph B and C, I think it shows why the position we're taking about what this is for, why that's the right position. Now, the other point I wanted to make about the quote from the brief that DUA provided is they say there is this distinction that exists, but they don't explain where in the world that distinction comes from. And it's certainly not anything that you can find in the CARES Act relating to who's covered by this program. As I said, the CARES Act is very clear. Either you're in or you're out. You're in box one or you're box two. And it doesn't say if you're not in box one for some not the right reason, then you don't get into box two. It doesn't create that kind of distinction. Again, it's supposed to be no overlap and no gaps. And that's the way the statutes work together. We're not saying that PUA is intended to replace state law in any way. They are intended to work together. And I think that the statutory language makes that clear, and the guidance from DUL only further reinforces that. The relator and thousands of other Minnesota high school students meet the definition of covered individual, and they are for that reason entitled to PUA benefits. They're ineligible for state unemployment compensation, and that is a reason why they should be getting these benefits, not a reason for disqualifying them. And so we request that Deed's denial of benefits be reversed. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Merce. Ms. Phillip, will you identify yourself for the record and then proceed when you are ready?
Of course. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So the PUA program was created to fill in certain gaps in the state unemployment insurance program. Those gaps include for individuals who were self-employed and not traditionally eligible for state benefits, people who didn't earn enough during their base period and didn't qualify to establish an account. But the PUA program was not created to operate as a self-contained independent statutory scheme. The CARES Act states that the Department of Labor provides PUA benefits through agreements with states. We attach that agreement to our brief, and that disaster unemployment assistance regulations apply. But importantly—
Can I just stop you though? Because as I understand your argument, it's that state law limits the statute and who's eligible under the statute. Whereas the argument of the relator is that the CARES Act actually expanded that coverage and it actually expanded assistance to people who would otherwise not be eligible. I mean that's a real contradiction. and what about the statute supports your restriction of the assistance rather than the argument taken by the relator here?
Sure. So shortly after the act was signed into law, a little bit over a week later, the Department of Labor issued Unemployment Insurance Program Letter 1620. And in the contract, the DOL told us, you have to follow our guidance. When the act was first passed, there were a lot of questions about how it would interact with state law, and the DOL started issuing guidance on that. The guidance clarified that the terms and conditions of the state law, which apply to claims for and the payment of regular compensation, apply to the payment of PUA to individuals. The UPL, I'll call it for short, went on to list examples of state law provisions that apply to the payment of PUA, and that included disqualification and disqualifying income provisions. So disqualification provisions are the same thing as eligibility requirements in Chapter 268 and those set forth in Section 268.085. So Relator argues that anybody who's ineligible for benefits for any reason and meets the other CARES Act criteria is eligible for PUA benefits. But if that were the case, that would make that instruction completely meaningless.
But how do you explain then that it's very clear that PUA benefits go to people who don't have an unemployment account built up necessarily? I mean, how is that then? They don't have a right under state law to any unemployment compensation. They haven't exhausted it. They just don't have it. So how does that, how do you explain that?
Okay, I will try. So to go to counsel's argument about two boxes, he said there's two boxes, you're eligible or you're ineligible. And that is the way that a lot of programs work, like a Social Security disability program, for example, but that's not the way the unemployment insurance program works. So under the UI system, an applicant must meet the requirements to establish a benefit account. So they must earn a certain amount of wages in covered employment during their base period. They must meet requirements based on separation from employment. And then they also must meet ongoing eligibility requirements for any week that they request benefits. So you can think of it as a number of boxes that an applicant must check off to be eligible for benefits for any week.
Under so it's state not law. Just, correct?
Correct, under state law.
Okay. Yep.
And Right. And so it's not just two boxes. It's a number of boxes. And what the CARES Act and the UPLs have done is kind of given us a checklist for PUA applicants. And that checklist is found in the CARES Act with the criteria set forth in Section 2102 of the Act, but it's also set forth in the UPLs. The UPLs give us additional instructions on which boxes we need to look at to pay PUA applicants.
So doesn't question 28 of the UIPL that you cited, the first one, dealing with full-time students who work part-time? I mean, doesn't that answer your question then?
It does not. So it's important to understand that particular question was in direct response to a question about the DUA regulations. So under the DUA regulations, full-time students who work part-time are not eligible for DUA benefits. So when the CARES Act was first enacted, we did not know if any students would be eligible for PUA benefits. DUA requires that an individual's principal source of income and livelihood be dependent on the individual's employment for wages. So what the UPL is doing is saying that this DUA requirement does not apply.
Can I just stop you again? Because I mean, the argument of Relator is that this statute defining what a covered individual is very clear. It's plain and unambiguous. And it does say that a covered individual is an individual who is not eligible for regular compensation or extended benefits under state or federal law or pandemic emergency unemployment compensation under Section 2107. And that's if they're not eligible, then they meet criteria number one. Where is the fallacy in that argument? I mean, do we even need to get to the guidelines when the statute is so plain and unambiguous?
I think it's helpful to look at the way that the CARES Act was rolled out. So the CARES Act was enacted quickly in an emergency to address a need for immediate relief. There were a lot of questions when it was enacted, so it became necessary to have this advisory process to clarify and explain how states were to administer the PUA program. So I think it is a little different than the statutory scheme that's enacted in a different set of circumstances. So when Deed signed the contract, we agreed to follow both the CARES Act and the operating instructions. And the operating instructions here.
Okay, but I don't want to leave the statute yet, because that's our first job, is to interpret the language of the statute. And, you know, we don't generally look at how long it was under consideration by the legislature or anything. We just need to look at the language of it. And what I wanted to understand, if you could answer this for me, is so under the definition of covered individual, as you well know, there are two capital Roman letters, capital Roman I and capital Roman II, right? And we've been dealing with capital Roman I, that the person certifies that they're otherwise able to work and available to work, and then they can't because of the COVID considerations. Okay, then there's an or under two, is self-employed, is seeking part-time employment, does not have sufficient work history, or otherwise does not qualify. Okay. I'm wondering whether, when I look at your brief and I hear you talk about self-employed, et cetera, that all is in Roman II. But Roman I is a separate and independent basis to be for an individual to be a covered individual. So in what circumstances that are covered by, in what circumstances does Deed pay ineligible people under the CARES Act when those people do not fall under Roman capital II? Are there examples of that? Your brief seemed to, and your argument today seemed to cite Roman II, self-employed, et cetera, but I'm not interested in that. I wanna know what Roman I is.
Sure. So individuals that Deed pays that would not be in Roman II would be people whose employment is non-covered employment under the statute. So in section 268035, subdivision 20, there's a list of non-covered employment. And that includes that's a long list, but example, employment for a church or a convention or association of churches or a nonprofit operated primarily for religious purposes. So if somebody worked for such an organization, their employment would be non-covered and they would not be eligible for state benefits. But under the CARES Act.
Okay, and why is it that, so explain to me the distinction with citing, under state law, they do not qualify, whatever word you use, because the federal law doesn't care that we say eligible, qualified, disqualified, right? It's a federal law for all 50 states. So what is the explanation for why those would be paid, those individuals would be paid, but not students who are ineligible under state law?
Because they're not excluded by, I know it is hard for me to explain, they're not excluded by a disqualification, state law disqualification provision. They're in non-covered employment. So they're not able to establish an account.
Covered by state law though, right? Not covered by state law. Like we could choose to cover them.
Right.
We've chosen not to as a state.
Right. So they're not able to.
Is that different from students?
Well, they're not able to establish an account in the first place. In order to establish an account, you need to earn so much in covered employment. So they would not even have gotten to the point of being able to establish a benefit account.
Doesn't that relate to their work history?
It does.
And isn't that then Roman 2? I mean, it seems like a lot of examples go to Roman 2, but Roman 1 must mean something because it's set up as an alternative under the federal statute.
Yeah, and I understand your point, and it is difficult to explain this distinction. And you know what I would say is, I think you get a clear picture of it when you read through the Act, but then when you read through the UPLs is where it fills in all of those gaps. And like what, I said, the CARES Act was.
I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt what Judge Smith is. Okay, if I just ask a quick question. So, sure. What specific language are you relying on then? With respect to Roman numeral 1 of the covered individual definition, to make this distinction about non-covered employment versus disqualified individuals like high school students, what yes. exact language are you relying on for that distinction?
Well, I would just say that it doesn't operate by itself. Looking at the Act, the Act does say that, you know, DUA regulations apply. So I think that even
but
looking
only
at the Act,
as only if, I mean, there's a hierarchy, right? Right. I'm sorry, I'll let you finish your answer because you don't have a lot of time left. No. Go ahead.
I think you have to look at both the DUA and then state law to see if there's any specific provisions. And if there is a specific disqualifying state law provision that applies that's not inconsistent with the CARES Act, then you have to apply it. And here, the disqualification provision for secondary students, it is consistent with the Act and with the UPLs. The Act is silent on secondary students, but the UPLs tell us that we have to apply state law disqualifying provisions. So we can't ignore them. If that's not a disqualification provision, you know, what is? It's an eligibility requirement in 268.085, which is eligibility requirements. So when the Act was enacted, it's not clear from the Act's language, but the Act does state that it's being administered pursuant to agreements with states, and it does state that DUA regulations apply. So the intent is that the program is not, you know, its own discrete analysis, that you do have to look to these other laws to see if they apply and go through that process that we've been referring to as the hierarchy of laws. So if you do have to look to the Act, if it's silent, you look to DUA, the Act and the operating instructions. If they're silent, then you go to DUA. If DUA is silent, then you go to state law. So the UPLs clarify that the program is to be run kind of together with these state law disqualification requirements. So, I mean, I agree that the language of the act is not, it's not an easy analysis. Deeds interpretation is based on, you know, trying to give meaning to all three kind of bodies of law that Department of Labor has instructed us to look at. So we are relying heavily on the UPLs, which is a little different type of analysis than, you know, in other circumstances, but it's because we did agree to follow the guidance issued by the Department of Labor, and that's what DEED is doing with the secondary school provision.
Well, could I just ask a question?
Certainly, go ahead.
You know, because I want to follow up on questions that Judge Smith was asking you, because it sounds like you are agreeing that there are individuals who do not qualify for state compensation or unemployment compensation, that those individuals would have a right to the PUC benefits, right?
Yes.
You're conceding that. Then how do you limit that analysis to a high school student? Why is a high school student in any different position than these other people who are deemed to be ineligible for state benefits? How does that comport with the plain and unambiguous language of the statute?
And again, it's you know, nothing in the UPLs makes, you know, secondary students eligible. We're applying that state law. For the other individuals that I mentioned that we find eligible for PUA, those are individuals that that the Act and the UPLs have said they intend to be eligible. People who aren't able to establish accounts, people who have exhausted their state UI, people who haven't earned enough. So those are individuals that are identified in the Act and in the UPLs as people who qualify for PUA. And they meet that threshold of being able to establish a PUA account. But that doesn't mean that the state, the ongoing eligibility requirements that we apply kind of on a week by week basis, those still apply. That's what the DOL has told us. So individuals traditionally unable to establish accounts for the reasons that the DOL has identified, those individuals are eligible for PUA, but we still have to apply these weekly requirements that we apply to every person under state law. And that's what the DOL has told us to do.
All right, any other questions for Ms. Phillip? No, all right. Mr. Mertz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we did allow Ms. Phillip a little extra time to respond to a question. So if need be, we are happy to do likewise for you. So go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't deny that the PUA has its complexities, but the issue that is in front of you now is not one of those complexities. The statute is remarkably clear. Your Honor asked about what language do we look to that justifies the distinction, and I didn't hear any language identified. And the fact of the matter is, when the CARES Act talks about who is a covered individual, it cares about whether the person is eligible for state benefits or whether they are not eligible for state benefits. It doesn't care about why they're ineligible. The language doesn't talk about whether the person is disqualified, whether they're in covered or uncovered employment. They don't talk about whether they're in an excluded job. And if you think about the purpose of this statute in the first place, to be a broad safety net, catch those people that fall through the cracks. The reason why they fall through the cracks is completely immaterial. That's the way the statute was drafted. That's the reason why the statute just makes this basic distinction, eligible or ineligible. My client and thousands of high school students like her are ineligible. And if they are unemployed because of any of the reasons that the statute allows for, then they are covered people, covered individuals, and they are entitled to PUA benefits. I don't have anything further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Any questions from my panel members? No, it doesn't look like it. All right. That will conclude this hearing and this session of the court. What we anticipate doing in light of the urgent nature of this question would be to probably issue an order with our decision with a written opinion to follow. So your arguments have been very helpful to us this morning, and we thank you, and we will try to get an order out as quickly as possible. And this concludes this session of our special term calendar, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you.